Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Folks like you make this show possible, and they do so by becoming a member. They go over to ROFpodcast.com. They sign up for literally pennies a day to support this program. And then what we do is we give them extra content every day and full access to over a decade's worth of archives. Check it out, ROFpodcast.com. It's your support that helps keep us on the air. Thank you for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, author Dina Srinivasan will be here to explain how digital advertising markets really work. Jeff Hauser from the Revolving Door Project joins us to discuss why Speaker Pelosi and Democratic leadership don't seem that interested in impeaching Donald Trump. SCOTUS expert Scott Lemieux will be here to give us a rundown on all the decisions made in this latest judicial session. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to analyze all the big news from this past week. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of the Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show. You can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show commercial-free and access to all of our archives. And head over to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. So, Heather, we were on vacation, obviously, last week, and as such, we did not have an opportunity to comment on Donald Trump's would-be, I guess, July 4th military celebration. As it were, I will cop to not watching any of it, really. I guess I saw some clips. I saw that it was raining. I obviously saw that he conflated some events, time sequences, basically jumbling up things, you know, that were probably about 150 years apart. But that happens to the best of us. What did you make of that whole fiasco? It didn't turn out to be the sort of the firebrand speech that people thought he would give. The whole thing was a bit of a dud.
Well, that's how I saw it. And I unfortunately did watch the whole thing because I had to write about it for my Salon column the next day. So that was my July 4th, was having to, first of all, watch the lead up to it, which everybody was wondering, was anybody going to show up? And, you know, what are the people at the thing talking about and what have you? So I was watching that stuff all day. It kind of ruined my holiday. But yeah, it was a dud. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, one of the things I think, and I keep pointing this out and nobody ever listens to me, it's a myth that Trump went to France on Bastille Day and saw the big parade and was inspired at that point and said, I want to have one of those myself. He had wanted to have one of those for ages and, in fact, had tried to do it for his inaugural. It was reported at the time that he had asked for a military parade for the inaugural, wanted the tanks and the soldiers marching and all that stuff, and they told him it couldn't be done. But he'd always had that in his head, and I suspect he's liked those military parades since he was a kid, right? I mean, he went to military school. He loves that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think that that was the inspiration for it. But, of course, when he saw what the French could do, he was, you know, determined that he was going to try to outdo them with a much better parade showing how much better the U.S. military is, which was the whole point, you know, to kind of show off the military as if nobody in the world understands that the United States has an incredible, you know, the most powerful military on earth. He needs, somehow feels we need to prove that. And so, you know, he planned this thing, and of course it was a dud because it was nothing. I mean, he got a couple of sad-looking tanks sitting there. It was just ridiculous and kind of pathetic that, you know, that was supposed to prove something. And then he had some, you know, these flyovers from the four branches of government, which were fine, but I mean, I've seen that at baseball games. You know, this isn't anything special. So if the point was to prove that the U.S. government, that the U.S. military is the strongest, most formidable in the world, boy, it did the opposite. It showed that the U.S. is, if that was the point, the U.S. is kind of lame when it comes to putting on a military parade, which is fine with me because I don't think we should be doing that. It's completely antithetical to the way the U.S., you know, has traditionally viewed the July 4th and the idea of, you know, marching the military all over the place because, you know, we don't, the point of doing that in dictatorships and other authoritarian regimes is that you're not only telling the rest of the world that you have a strong military, you're telling your own people,
right?
You know, which is kind of instilling fear, you know, saying, hey, look, you know, this is your government here. So, you know, be sure and keep that in mind when you try and dissent. So, you know, the U.S. has never traditionally done that. So Trump tries to do it. And of course, you know, it's raining. He can't read the speech. The speech sounded like it was written for somebody else. And it's pretty clear it's the first time he'd ever, you know, laid eyes on it because he didn't know any of the things that were in it. So it was a mess.
We should say that,
that
at one point he stumbled, the teleprompter stumbled or something stumbled, and maybe he was ad-libbing and he was talking about how the revolutionary forces took over the airports. I hope we don't have
to
explain to our audience.
Very well, Sam. He can't read very well. So this happens all the time. It's just that in that case, because he doesn't know anything about American history and is completely clueless, when he misread it, as he does all the time, he probably said, instead of port, he said airport, and then he skipped over some part and talked about, you know, Fort McHenry and the rocket's red glare, which was really the War of 1812, not the Revolutionary War. Or maybe they might have written that in there. I don't even know. I mean, maybe the people who wrote him wrote the speech don't know American history. But the idea of Trump sitting there talking about American history in lofty terms and doing all this, it's just not him. It was the phoniest speech he's ever read. It's clearly is not what he thinks about America. Any kind of discussion of any of it, even the military successes of the United States, his view of successful military action is, you know, Black Jack Pershing, the apocryphal story of Black Jack Pershing dipping bullets in pig's blood, you know, to scare the Muslims. I mean, that's the military that he likes, the one that tortures, you know, the one that steals resources. I mean, this idea of, you know, wrapped around freedom and, you know, freeing other people around the world, I mean, it has nothing to do with him, and it sounded like it had nothing to do with him.
Well,
I mean, it was clear.
My thought was that in the run-up to the speech, there was, I will cop to not paying much attention to even the build up to the speech, because the only thing I heard about was, you know, the tanks and the idea that the Park Service was going to have to spend millions of dollars to service these tanks being brought in at a time where the Park Service is already being starved of funds. But my sense is that there was a lot of concern that, you know, along with the militarism, that he was going to be far more political about the speech. They did just hand out VIP tickets only to members of the RNC as opposed to the DNC, which is, you know, pretty ridiculous for a July 4th celebration. But I can't help but wonder if they almost at the last minute switched speeches, because he did seem unfamiliar with that speech. The speech did seem sort of very atypical. It did seem to be written to sort of surprise people as being almost as banal and mundane as it was. I can't help but think that there is a heightened sensitivity or some type of notion of like, oh, we're in an election year. We've got to be a little bit careful with some of this stuff. in terms of the media. But I don't know. I mean, you know, I think they are a little bit concerned about stepping out of, I don't know what lane it was. Maybe they just think there was going to be more people paying attention there that weren't necessarily partisan. But the whole thing turned out.
I think it was the military. I think it was the military that I think that their reluctance over this whole thing and being used, because there had been discussions of putting, you know, all four joint chiefs and stuff up behind him and all that. And they did bring up a couple, but they didn't. It wasn't just a bunch of uniforms surrounding him. I think that may have been what tempered them.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's take a break. We've got a lot more to talk about. Obviously, a crazy week. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be right back with Heather Parton. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, obviously, we've got some big political stories, obviously, in the news. The census question, not the least of which. There's some court cases that are pretty important. There's stuff happening with the Democrats in Congress. Maybe not enough happening with the Democrats in Congress. But I want to touch on this story about Jeffrey Epstein. I don't cover, as a rule, criminal cases, broadly speaking. When things get to court, from a public policy standpoint, more often than not, that's basically where I sort of say, okay, let the court proceedings happen. But this story about Jeffrey Epstein is fascinating and important for a multitude of reasons. The first is that this is a guy, a billionaire. People are very unclear on how he made his money, but we can return to that. This is a guy who was convicted, or at least I should say pled, to multiple counts of basically running a prostitution ring with underage girls in Florida. This was an investigation that was brought initially by the FBI and by the feds. In fact, the U.S. attorney at the time made the plea deal with him, and according to reporting by the Miami Herald, called it an incredible sweetheart deal. This is a guy who was being investigated by the FBI for federal charges. He pled to this prostitution, a lesser offense, and got 13 months in a county jail where he was able to go out and work every day, go to work. He's a billionaire now, so it's not like he's, you know, who knows what he's doing in his office. He had to register as a sex offender, but it also cleared all of his co-conspirators who never had to serve any jail time. And the big thing was that this U.S. attorney never cleared the deal with any of the 36 victims of this basically child predator. And a federal judge, based upon this reporting recently in February, said that the law was broken. Well, it turns out that that U.S. attorney is now the Secretary of Labor. This guy, Acosta. So that has political implications. But the other thing is that Jeffrey Epstein has had relationships with some of the most powerful people in this country. And one of them was Donald Trump. In fact, Donald Trump was sued by a woman, now a woman, in California and then was refiled in New York, although she withdrew it in the run-up to the election because she was afraid, supposedly, on the basis that, Donald Trump had sexually assaulted her in Jeffrey Epstein's home years earlier. So all this coming to a head when the New York U.S. Attorney Office has indicted Jeffrey Epstein. And this thing could go in a myriad of places, couldn't it, Digby?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, and it setting aside all the details that you just put up, including, you know, I mean, he was friends with Bill Clinton as well, and basically apparently gave him use of his plane to do a lot of, and accompanied him in some cases, on a lot of Clinton Foundation business back in the early 2000s, and Clinton has denied that he knew anything about any of this underage stuff and says that he had Secret Service people with him the whole time and what have you. But that those connections, including Clinton and Trump and, you know, people like Prince Andrew and God knows who else, just what it says, aside from the horror of the charges themselves, which are really awful. I mean, the stuff, this was a sex trafficking ring that he ran, recruiting young girls to, you know, service him and his friends. Alan Dershowitz, the famed lawyer, is one of the primary people exposed, implicated in this, accused by one or more of the women now who were young girls at the time of being involved in this whole thing, and who also defended Epstein in his case in Florida. What this says about our culture at large, I mean, you know, this goes beyond the normal corruption. I mean, this is not something that you can sort of attribute to, well, all the big money guys, they kind of, you know, they're kind of working together and there's corrupt dealings and what have you, all of which is awful. But this says is that you can literally do anything and that you can find protection. And it does seem as though Epstein was, from the very beginning, finding ways to protect himself by, you know, cultivating these powerful people, and that plenty of these powerful people were willing to sort of lend their names to him, or at least be involved with him. I mean, Trump said back in 2002, when in a profile of Epstein, he said, "I've known Jeff for 15 years. Terrific guy. He's a lot of fun to be with. It's even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side." I mean, he knew, obviously. I mean, he clearly knew that Epstein had a thing about beautiful women on the younger side, and, you know, he basically, and, you know, it's not like Epstein's troubles with the law were a secret. I mean, that came out in the mid-2000s and the late-2000s. He hired, you know, Trump hired Acosta, and this came up in the confirmation hearings. Not that anybody did anything about it, but, you know, it came up in the confirmation hearings, and Trump knew about Epstein, and he knew that Acosta was had been one of the assistant U.S. Had been the U.S. attorney for the Florida region who actually let Epstein off the hook. So he knew all that. And what this says is just that, you know, at a certain level in this country, apparently you can get away with anything. I mean, I think, isn't that the sort of pervading sense of what's happening in the Trump era?
Well, that is, I mean, it's the pervading sense of what's happening in the Trump era and the era leading up to it. I mean, I think the idea is that in this instance, it's pretty narrow. But broadly speaking, this notion of people who are so powerful that they can buy and in many respects live outside of the law is a serious problem that we have in society. And you can apply this dynamic not just in this sort of narrow instance, but broadly as well. I mean, the idea that these people would allow a billionaire to get away with what we consider to be the greatest offense you could have in our society, I think, you know, is basically is pedophilia. I mean, it gives you a sense of, like, what wouldn't they let a billionaire get away with in our society? I mean, what would they stop them at? And I think it's very little, to be honest with you. All right. Well, we've got to take a break. We'll be back with more in the next hour from Digby. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, we'll catch up on decisions made by the Supreme Court in their latest judicial session. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back with more Ring of Fire Radio.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours pouring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Joining me now to discuss decisions made by the Supreme Court in this latest judicial session that just ended, SCOTUS expert Scott Lemieux. So, Scott, what I want to do is obviously look back on this Supreme Court term that has now ended and note the important cases that have an impact right now, and also look into some of those cases that may not have massive impact at the moment, but appear to head down a trajectory. I guess we should probably take the most recent decisions first. And that, of course, would be two cases that came down just last week. One is the Department of Commerce versus New York. This dealt with the census question on immigration, or I should say immigration status or citizenship status. And the other was a series of cases, Rucho versus Common Cause, which was rolled into another case, Benezek versus Lamone, which were the gerrymandering cases. Let's start with the good news, and then we'll just get darker as we go on. And that seems to me to come from the census case.
Right. So, and it's kind of remarkable in that, after oral argument, most people were very pessimistic about the Department of Justice, Commerce had tried to add a question about citizenship to the census, even though the Census Department, had evidence that this would substantially reduce participation of minority communities, especially people of Latino descent. And certainly after oral argument, it didn't look good. One interesting thing that happened is that the estranged daughter of the architect of this question basically found a thumb drive with a bunch of his emails that were brought to the attention of the lower courts that, were basically the smoking gun that, let's do this because it'll suppress the counting of racial minorities, which means less federal funding, less federal representation, and it would provide information that would allow for even more egregious gerrymandering, as we'll get to next time.
And let me just say, you're not being metaphorical, and you're barely paraphrasing. I mean, I think the words were, it would strengthen, it would empower non-white Latinos and Republicans, I think was directly from that report and modeling that he did.
Yeah, it was like that. I'm not even exaggerating. I guess he was really saying the quiet parts loud. And what's even more ridiculous is that the stated reason that the Commerce Department gave for making the change is that it would help the Trump administration enforce the Voting Rights Act. You know, the irony being not only that the Roberts Court has gutted the Voting Rights Act, but literally the Trump administration has not filed a single lawsuit to enforce the Voting Rights Act since coming into power. And, you know, obviously Roberts couldn't cite that evidence, but it seems likely, particularly given that he cited, you know, he was much more generous to the Trump administration than was really warranted. You know, in addition to the impermissible motives, really the regulation was just incompetently put forward, and the lower courts just gave very careful, persuasive evidence that it violated the Administrative Procedures Act. And Roberts, you know, didn't buy any of those arguments. You know, he's bending over backwards to defer to the Trump administration. But he basically just had to conclude, like, the explanations offered by Ross and the evidence are just too inconsistent. Like, it's just, you know, like, more or less, it's just, don't lie this egregiously, essentially. That, you know, you're making me look bad. Now, what was interesting is that, you know, Roberts is, you know, so, you know, Breyer for the three other liberals wrote an opinion essentially arguing, you know, the question is inherently bad the way it was put forward in a way that wouldn't have given, you know, any practical time for it to be on the census. Roberts, you know, just said it should go back to the lower courts, more or less inviting the Department of Commerce to come up with something that didn't embarrass them quite as much. But in the interim, lawyers in the Department of Justice have suggested that the census will go forward without the question. And I would suspect that what lawyer, and of course Trump today came out and said fake news, but I think what the actual lawyers are saying is that, you know, you don't want that smoking gun evidence. You know, now lower courts can consider that. And, you know, basically that I think lawyers in the Department of Justice just want this all to go away so they don't make arguments that will, you know,
well, I actually
them down the road.
Scott, I got to tell you, I think it gets worse than that, too, because yesterday, Donald Trump, in being asked by the press about that question at some type of like conference they were having at the White House, when he was asked that question, he immediately went into the problems that we have with immigrants in this country. And that to me also, like, if the answer is it's the Voting Rights Act, or if the answer is we need it to perform these and that functions, Donald Trump, again, blew it for them because he went out and said, no, it's something totally different, not what we offered the court the first time, and not something that we could ever defend in court, which is that we don't like immigrants in this country. We shouldn't be counting them anyways. Well, the Constitution. So I think that had as much to do with the Justice Department saying, oh, now we have it's impossible for us to make this argument. But it is amazing what it took, because this, there couldn't have been, I mean, literally, if Wilbur Ross had called up John Roberts, or had, you know, showed up on this front lawn of his house and said, I lied, I don't know that it could have been more explicit than, frankly, that. So that's the good news, that we know, at least have a sense of how blatant things have to be for the court to do the right thing. Let's get into the less good news. Let's talk about the gerrymandering. This is pretty devastating for democracy, isn't it? I mean, do you think there's, and maybe there's a competition as to what's going to resonate more, this decision or the others we'll talk about in a moment, but tell us the import of these gerrymandering cases.
Yeah, it's bad. So obviously, you know, the court here had to consider, you know, a couple gerrymander by Democrats in Maryland that wasn't that, you know, transformed a 6-2 House majority to 7-1, and a more serious North Carolina gerrymander. But essentially what the court did was hold that gerrymandering was a political question. And for the non-com law people out there, that means that it's a question that the courts just cannot consider. Now, one important thing here is that even Roberts was not willing to claim that these elections were consistent with the First and 14th Amendment. So Roberts could have ruled these gerrymanders are constitutional. He didn't do that. He just said that the courts cannot remedy these things. And it's important to remember what's going on here. In the Wisconsin State House right now, in 2018, Republicans got 45% of the votes and 64% of the seats. So, you know, Democrats won the popular vote by 8 points, and were, you know, got less than 40% of the seats of the legislature. That's an unbreakable gerrymander. You know, this isn't like an old time, you know, the gerrymander gives you a marginal advantage or protects a couple of incumbents. I mean, this is entrenching rule by one party, even if they lose decisively. And one real danger of this is that, you know, when Kennedy was on the court doing his Hamlet routine, you know, Republicans had to worry that, you know, they could go too far, that they could pass the gerrymander that caused Kennedy to say, I can't stomach, sort of like what happened to Roberts in this case. You know, with now that Roberts has said, you know, I don't care. You know, literally a party can permanently entrench itself, even if it loses elections by double digits, that's fine. You know, they have no reason not to engage in Wisconsin-type gerrymandering, which modern computer models make very possible. And it's also worth noting that his decision is just incredibly specious. You know, his argument, on the one hand, he argues, you know, there's no way to possibly come up with judicial standards to apply this. And then he says, well, don't worry, state courts can take care of it. But as Kagan says, that's, you know, you're literally saying that courts can't do what courts are already doing. You know, Pennsylvania courts drew up a fair map. It didn't, you know, it basically represented, it actually still slightly overrepresented Republicans, but, you know, it was much more fair. You know, that, and this is the same thing we went through in the 50s, that conservatives on the court said, oh, you can't have, you know, one person, one vote. You can't have fair districts. There's no standards. It won't work. Well, the Warren Court did that. It worked out fine. It was popular. There's no problems. You know, so it's just nonsense to say that you couldn't come up with standards that would limit the practice. But obviously, Roberts chose not to. And the fact that, you know, gerrymandering on balance, you know, greatly favors Republicans is not a coincidence here.
So we have that case, and it's let me just before we well, I guess we get to take a break. When we come back, I want to just ask you one more thing about the gerrymandering, and that is what we now know about the viability of independent commissions drawing districts. And then I want to talk about a couple of cases that will have to do with the ability of regulatory agencies to function more or less in the future under the auspices of this Roberts Court. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to Scott Lemieux from the blog Lawyers, Guns, and Money about the latest Supreme Court judicial session. So, Scott, in the last segment, you were walking us through the census question case of the Supreme Court. You were walking us through the gerrymander case, which was far more devastating. One last question on the gerrymandering. Now that we know that John Roberts has basically given a green light to the most egregious partisan gerrymandering that anyone can think up of, it's basically like there is, we are standing down, you guys go to town. Where does that leave us in terms of state legislatures deferring to independent commissions that might be set up by the state legislature or by referendum to draw these districts? Is that still viable? Because 7 years ago, John Roberts said in a decision that those were not legitimate because the state legislatures could not delegate this authority. What about now?
Yeah, Roberts at least seemed to back off that, so that, you know, and obviously, partly I would suspect in response to Kagan, whose dissent was pretty devastating. He both said, essentially state courts could deal with this, state legislatures can deal with this, and he also suggested that federal legislation could deal with this. Although, given his record about the Voting Rights Act, I wouldn't, as Kagan pointed out, there have been plenty of proposals, none of which passed. And if you get a Congress that can pass that, I wouldn't bet that Roberts wouldn't find something wrong with it. But at least on its face, he did leave open a bunch of state tools. And there certainly are things that states can do. But there is a real sort of collective action problem here, which is that, generally states like California, Colorado, have fair nonpartisan redistricting, but they can't do anything about states like North Carolina and Wisconsin. And when it comes to, reapportioning, for House districts, what that means is that the fairer your state's elections, the less representation the preferences of your voters get at the national level. So
yeah,
a situation where, California fairly represents both parties, but red states don't, is actually not, that's not really a solution to the problem, at least federally. So, and it's a real dilemma for blue states, because I think Democrats are right to think that elections should be fair, that if people vote for Republicans, Republicans should get representation in those areas. But there's going to be a real temptation why shouldn't California be just as egregiously gerrymandered as North Carolina? And that's exactly why the Supreme Court should have, this is where you need a federal solution that solves the problem.
Right.
It's not really something that can be solved, on a state-by-state basis. It requires, a uniform federal standard so that everybody is treated fairly.
Okay, we only have about 4 or 5 minutes left here. I want to talk about two other cases. That's Gundy and Kaiser or Wilkie. These are cases that are going to implicate or could implicate down the road the ability of regulatory agencies to do their jobs. Explain to us.
Yeah, well, to start with a slightly happier one first, the Kaiser case, Kagan was able to put together a narrow majority to keep the rule that, basically the court should defer to agencies' interpretations of their own rulings. How much that means, I don't know, in the sense that, the rule is written narrowly enough that, more or less if the Supreme Court, it doesn't say that, it's unlimited deference. So whether that'll actually stop the court from doing anything it wants to do, I don't know. But it's significant in the sense that, there was an invitation to overrule two precedents that would have overruled that rule, and Roberts didn't go along. So, I guess it's just, to the extent it's better than the alternative, at least.
Illustrate to us what the practical application of that rule might look like, just hypothetically.
Right. Yeah. So basically, it's, that the idea is that, if an agency is sort of, construing its own regulations, what, some libertarians have always wanted is for the courts to say, we don't care. Executive agencies can't really be trusted. We need the courts to impose their own view of whether regulations are valid. And, essentially the court declined to do, basically said, no, we should defer to when agencies are interpreting their own rules. We should give them deference. But again, that's not, there are exceptions.
Right.
The interpretation has to be reasonable. So, I don't, whether practically that really meant, that it could be that the precedents remain in force, but Roberts is just more willing to say that the interpretations aren't reasonable. But again, it's better. They could have overruled those precedents and they didn't. I would say that it's certainly better than the alternative. We'll have to see how it plays out. I would say that that's the best outcome that could have been hoped for there.
So the other case that's relevant in this respect, Gundy.
So this is more disturbing. So there were a couple of cases in the 30s in which the Supreme Court tried to impose something called non-delegation doctrine, that they struck down executive actions that, on the grounds that Congress had given too much power to the executive and hadn't really made a policy choice. Well, in this case, it was a classic, but it's been ignored for the last 84 years. And in this case, Congress made a, in my view, a bad decision, but a decision it could make by retroactively applying a sex offender registration statute. And it just told the Department of Justice to do so you know, when as soon as it was practical. So it's the classic, you know, we made a policy choice, but we rely on your expertise to say, is that, does that take 100 days? Does that take a year? Well, three justices, including Roberts, held that this was an unconstitutional delegation. And Kavanaugh was not on the court yet. And really disturbingly, Alito filed a concurrence just in the judgment, but basically said, there's no point in making an exception for this case. But if we're willing to radically reconsider and bring back on delegation doctrine, then I would be on board. What that probably means is that as soon as Kavanaugh can hear a case, we're about to see a revival of non-delegation doctrine. And if you think about that case, you know, what happened in this case happens all the time. You know, virtually all environmental regulation in the United States centers on Congress creates a goal, and it's up for the experts in the EPA to flesh that out. You know, Congress can't do the testing to find out how much mercury is too toxic. You know,
right.
How do you address that problem?
We want clean air. We're going to leave it up to the scientists to determine what constitutes clean air, essentially.
Right. You know, and that, yeah, there's a million cases like that when you're regulating fisheries, you know, you have to be, you have to work with local, you know, fishermen. How many fish are available? How dangerous is the technology? You know, how does that rule work? Do we have to change it? You know, the idea that Congress can make all of these decisions for even one area, let alone all of them, is just absurd. And again, if you think of the facts of this case, you know, Congress made a clear policy judgment. And again, I don't think it's a good policy judgment. I agree, of course, with that.
Right.
But that's not the job of the courts to decide. And or if you want to decide on a due process grounds, fine. But it's just, you know, if you can't even do that, if you can't say, look, it's up to the Department of Justice to determine how fairly they could do that, you know, it would just create chaos for the regulatory framework. You know,
we should say it's a full frontal assault on the regulatory framework, and we will see if the Republicans are able basically to make these regulatory agencies in the future completely defanged and incapable of carrying out broad principles and instructions from Congress. Scott Lemieux, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks very much, Sam. Anytime.
Scott Lemieux is an assistant professor of political science at the College of St. Rose. He contributes to the blogs Lawyer Guns and Money and Vox Pop. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from this past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.